You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, hello, lovely listeners. I am recording this little hello from Washington. I'm in Seattle for the Seattle Erotic Film Festival, which means for 3 days, I am watching porn in a theater with a whole bunch of other people. It's a variety of erotic film. Some of it includes sex. Some of it is just erotic. And to be honest, the first one that I saw was pretty disappointing. To sit through an entire film of stereotypical male gaze, of young, white, also only wearing white, virginal, thin women just like frolicking through fields is an old trope, but there is so much for me to see and learn, and hopefully I'll connect with some local filmmakers. Since you all know, I went through erotic film school, and I'm interested in moving into that space at some point. So this week, I have Dr. Sheila Luanzen, who is an OBGYN, and she recently put out a book called Yes, I Have Herpes. She has a very personal story of acquiring herpes in college and then hiding that fact from partners for over 10 years before she started doing some work with a coach and decided it was time to be honest with herself and with others. There's wonderful conversations in the book that she has with past partners where she finally discloses her status. And she has all kinds of medical information about the herpes virus and what it actually is, how we can be more compassionate to ourselves around things like STIs. We also have some fun talking about the ways that vulva and labia look and smell, since I tend to get emails from people who are worried about the way that they look pretty frequently. And then we also talk about what makes for a great pap smear and what trauma survivors and trans folks can do to help find better care. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Sheila, and then we will jump in. And of course, next week, I will give you a full rundown of all of the films that I saw at this weekend's Erotic Film Festival. So Dr. Sheila Luanzen, also known as the Compassionate Gynecologist, is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist with over 15 years of patient and personal experience with the diagnosis of herpes. Dr. Luanzen offers women specific tools to shift their perspective, gain insight, and move forward confidently and in self-love. Dr. Luanzen received her BA in biochemistry at Vassar College and completed medical school at the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific. She currently works at a large multi-specialty practice in California. Also, don't forget, if you love the show and you want to support it, you can go to patreon.com/sexgetsreal. $1 a month, $2 a month, $5 a month, every single dollar helps me to keep doing this show. So thank you so much for listening. And here is my chat with Dr. Luanzen, all about herpes. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Dr. Sheila. I love that we're going to be talking about herpes today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. So we were talking a little bit before we got on air, and I mentioned that last year I had someone on the show talking about sexual health research and herpes and the stigma that's kind of associated with it. And so I love that we're talking about this today, because I think the more that we talk about it, the less stigma we have and the more permission slips we kind of write for folks out there. Mm-hmm. And so I want everyone to know first that you wrote a book called Yes, I Have Herpes. And I'd love to know for you, what's that been like to kind of have this like big coming out process that's beyond just conversations with partners, but kind of announcing to the world like, hey, here I am.
Yeah, it's been definitely a wonderful journey. So the book came out about a year ago, and I think it's been phenomenal. the reason why I ended up coming out with the book is because I wanted to put a face to the virus, that number one, that my friends knew, that my patients knew, and just kind of give that support to people who may not normally see it, from their physician, from their friends, from their community. And it's been great. I think that my medical colleagues have thought it was a wonderful support to give to people out there, because we see how the virus can change people. And I think it's helpful for patients to see that there is somebody out there advocating for them and really trying to educate the community to hopefully change that stigma. That was my biggest thing. And then also educating the community that it's not a typical stereotype. There is a face behind this virus, and it really isn't something that should be stigmatized or that we should be ashamed of. So I just really wanted to kind of normalize the conversation. And throughout all of my interviews and my my micro blogs on Facebook, I'm just really just trying to educate everybody and give that emotional support that patients don't always get, even from their physicians in the office, just because it's such a limited amount of time.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I know that just because of kind of how the medical system is set up in the West specifically, I can't speak to a lot of other places, but, you know, doctors often have very little time with patients. And I also just finished doing a 6-month training with medical students to help them get 6 months of sexual health and sex education. And I know that's a little unusual. So a lot of physicians also don't typically get lots of sex education around, like, how do we talk about kink? And how do we talk about multiple sexual partners without shaming folks? And so I think a lot of people get a diagnosis like this and then end up feeling very alone, or like the delivery was really cold, and now they're kind of just like swimming without direction.
Yeah, I just recently this month had a patient who came, who was recently diagnosed by one of my colleagues, had found out where I worked and said, is it okay if I come see you? And I spoke to her for like an hour. I mean, I could talk about this for hours and hours. And so, you know, it was important to give the information and the emotional support, just because there's a lot of confusion out there. And a lot of times physicians just don't have time. In a 15-20 minute appointment where we're trying to do various other things like pap smears and, you know, education and vaccinations, it's really hard to add that on top of everything else.
Yeah. So one of the things that you've said, which I really love, and I just kind of like want to reiterate this, is herpes is a virus, and, you know, we don't shame people for colds and flus and a bajillion other viruses. And you've said that herpes is basically a skin condition. And so when we think about it that way, there's so many different skin conditions all of us either have or will have, like eczema and rashes and who knows what.
Zits,
exactly. And so it's literally not the lesions and the management of having herpes that people are scared of. It's the social stigma that we recently just saw with the big Usher mess that's going on. And unfortunately, that stigma drives people to then hide or lie or just not get tested, because then they can claim ignorance of not knowing, which I think for a lot of people seems easier because it's a lot less vulnerable.
Yeah, we're certainly in a community where it's conversation has kind of gone by the wayside. You know, we text so readily and email. The art of communicating a thought, I think, from one person to another has changed. And so out on top of that, this like social pressure that we get, and, you know, situations like the Usher news outbreak, which really, you know, I was excited because I was like, yes, a celebrity. And then, you know, by paying off this woman without really knowing the full medical history. And as a physician, I want to know the full medical history and kind of the course of this history, this present, this presentation that she had. We really can't say exactly, you know, what judgments we can pass on someone. And so it just made it, I almost feel kind of worse. And I was just like, come on, Usher, come on out. Let's do this. Let's, you know, work together. But, you know, not everybody is in that space, and we just have to respect that.
So one of the things that I get very regularly on the show is people who, for a variety of reasons, are avoiding a tough conversation, whether it's
divorce, or I think I might be kinky, or I think I might be gay, or whatever it is. And it's this fear that comes with being left and being rejected and being humiliated. And I know that there are people listening who know that they have some type of STI and have not communicated that with partners because of the shame. And I know a big part of your story was that you didn't disclose to partners for 10 years after you found out.
Yeah. You know, I think it ultimately, with any situation, it comes down to self-love and self-confidence. For myself, I think the reason why I had a very tough time disclosing is because I really wanted to have that love from a partner. And I thought that if I could manipulate a situation and look a specific way and act a specific way and be, in quotes, clean as I can be, that I would be so lovable and, you know, and worth it. And it was actually really focusing inward and building that self-confidence just on my own, was I able to say, you know what, this is part of who I am. I accept this. I love this. And then I can go forward and get essentially what I wanted. And that was what was so ironic, is because I was in these situations where I was with partners who were cheating on me, lying, taking my money, and I was willingly giving it in hope of an exchange of love. And I was just like, there's some common thread, and in the end, it's me. So there's got to be something that I'm putting out subconsciously and consciously. And when I started working with my executive coach, it was just kind of like, do you think it's the fact that I've never told anyone I have herpes? And he's just like, oh my gosh, this is so huge. Because if you're looking in a mirror every day and you're thinking, I'm not worthy, I can't be loved, I deserve to feel dirty, I should feel alone, of course it's gonna end up attracting that same thoughts. So it was once I started to identify that, and my book kind of covers how I kind of went through that process, could I actually realize, you know what, I can stand on my own. And if I disclose and someone doesn't like me, then that's okay. Go ahead and move on. You weren't the right partner for me. On to the next. And I found that it actually attracted better people to me. I got better partners. And then I finally got the chance to choose. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, here's someone here, let me just attach right on because of scarcity, this may never happen again. It was actually like, do I even like this person? Do I see a future with this person? And so everything just shifted. And I really, that's what I would encourage, you know, listeners out there and the people that, you know, hopefully lives that I touch can see.
I love so much what you said about being able to actually choose rather than feeling like I'd better grasp at this because it might be my only chance, and then settling for terrible things and feeling worse and not knowing why everything feels like it's falling apart. Yep. You know, I've told listeners this so many times, but I'm in a fat body. And for me, I found the exact same thing of when I disclose up front, I'm in a fat body, which by society is seen certainly a very specific way, that people were able to self-select out of even giving me their time and energy, so that the people who remained were people who I could really, truly have great conversations with and not be carrying this shame of how long can I hide this? Yeah. And so I love that you even wrote in the book that having herpes was a natural filter for partners. And I adore that you were able to get to a place where you saw, like, this gives me a chance to just be living in my truth constantly, to not have to apologize for who I am. And so now I actually can be very abundant in, like, I get to choose who deserves me.
And that was the difficulty that I was having, because here I am, Dr. Lawanzen, the professional, educating these patients on how to practice safe sex. And then here I am, the patient, not doing that. And there was this huge disconnect of, like, my professional life and my personal life. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting to have to try to make all those things match. And so I realized that if I could just marry these two things together, I could live just so much more in my truth. And in the end, I was looking for a partner that was open and educated and wanting to get to know me. And that was what was coming through down the line, because I had invested in myself. I mean, it definitely took some work, but I mean, it's just so worth it to make yourself a priority.
I love that so much. And I think that's so important, especially for people who are parents or for folks who are super busy and always caring for other people of, like, we have to find ways, even in the smallest ways, to care for ourselves. And I think, like, so many of us are so stuck in, if I just keep doing and performing and trying to be enough and be perfect, mm-hmm. that we kind of forget how to even trust ourselves or listen to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think what's so interesting about your story was that by working with your coach, it gave you an opportunity to actually do these really beautiful self-care practices and to mm-hmm. actually realize, like, I have a lot to offer and I deserve this, and to start prioritizing time for yourself every day. I mean, that's something like all of us need to be doing, but mm-hmm. I think especially people that tend to give too much of themselves.
And I think, you know, my practice is an OBGYN practice. So often I see women in their 40s and 50s who are really displaying all of that hard work. And so they're coming in anxious, insomnia, depressed, you know, just trying to figure out what. And I'm just like, if we could just dial it back to that time, you know, where you were vulnerable and just own some of the things that perhaps we kind of swept under the rug, I think maybe you'd have a larger emotional release and things would just end up falling into place.
Yeah. So you did this beautiful thing in your book where you actually included the conversations yes. that you had when you mm-hmm. disclosed to yeah. your previous partners that you hadn't disclosed to at the time. Mm-hmm. And I felt so distressed for you when I was reading those. And yeah. you actually, for the most part, had some really lovely responses mm-hmm. and conversations with people. But I'm wondering, like, what was it for you to actually write those messages and say those things and then to kind of like wait for the blow almost of like, God, what yeah. are they going to say back?
Yeah. You know, it was nerve-wracking. It was nerve-wracking. But, you know, in those experiences, I had felt before I had disclosed, I had always felt like the waves were kept crashing over me. Like I kept feeling like knocked down. And when is the rug going to be pulled out? And I just felt very unstable. And when I decided to disclose to these partners, I just had to really think, okay, remember who you are, remember the work that you've put in, remember the person that, you know, you want to be, and then whatever falls, falls. Because in the end, I had to have ownership of it. I had to realize I put myself in this situation, I put these people in these situations, I have to deal with the repercussions. And so I wanted to include those stories because you could also see the transition of the partners through the history and know that everybody had their own experience and they're completely entitled to it. And I can't fault them because it's their experience. And I just wanted to be very honest. And, you know, the book was coming out and I just wanted to share what space I was in. And some were great, some were not. You know, people are in different spaces and I have to respect that.
I think that's something that's so important for all of us to remember whenever we're doing any kind of act that's really vulnerable mm-hmm. or we could potentially get really hurt or rejected, of like, if we're sharing something really big, especially if it impacts somebody else's health potentially or mm-hmm. their life, like they're allowed to feel angry and betrayed mm-hmm. and to have big emotional responses. Mm-hmm. And we can hope that it's a nice, easy thing. But I love how you just left space of like, all I can do is the best I can do. And mm-hmm. then if they need to be angry at me and say things mm-hmm. like, they're allowed to do that. And I think that's such an emotionally mature way to handle that, that shows a lot of the work you've done.
And I think that I really wanted to respond to their concerns and not react, right? Because the emotional reaction is usually where a lot of us come from, just kind of that, you know, palpitations, sweating, shaking, you know, perspective. And I really wanted to come from a space of just responding if they had questions, if they had concerns, if they were wondering what their health was going to be like. And so it was emotionally trying, but in the end, you know, everybody was really wonderful and they're all great people. And some of the relationships worked out, some of them didn't, and that's okay.
Yeah. You know, it's not safe for everyone to disclose certain things. Like, it's not safe for everyone to come out. Mm-hmm. It's not always safe for someone to disclose something if they're in a potentially violent situation. Mm-hmm. But barring those situations, I think what's so beautiful, and I've experienced this too in my life, of when we're constantly trying to pretend or hide it takes up so much energy mm-hmm. and it takes up so much of our resources that we're not really showing up for ourselves or anyone else, and how you can feel in your story kind mm-hmm. of this like sigh when you mm-hmm. just kind of surrender to like, okay, this is who I am and I get to live in this truth, and whether people like it or not, I can't control that, but like, this is mm-hmm. me. And it felt like all of this space just kind of came into your story.
It was very cathartic. And it's interesting, before I'd actually written the book, you know, first of all, to build the confidence to write that book, I remember when my executive coach had said, you know, I think you should write a book. And I said, you are crazy town. No one is going to pay attention to this. I am going to be out there standing on a ledge and no one will understand. My perspective ended up changing because I realized that if I could use this book to even help just one person out there, then I did my job. You know, I do my best in my daily practice to help patients and give reassurance and open up perspective, because that's a lot of what medicine is. And if I could extend that even further to a larger community, that's really what I wanted to do. And, you know, the responses have been really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the vulnerability of you. Because I think too often the stories that we hear mm-hmm. are, here's all the things you should do. And if you don't do those things, you're a bad person. Mm-hmm. Or here's all the things that you can do. And I've done them perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I love that you just made it very clear. Like, I had to go on my own journey and I made some mistakes and it was kind of ugly for a while, but yeah. Here's where I've come to. And so kind of this like story of you can mess up and still be worthy and lovable and powerful and have wonderful relationships, even if you've made some mistakes.
And people can change. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. I mean, if I was judged on the person that I was when I was 20 years old, oh my goodness, could you imagine what if we were judged on the way that we were when we were in college? You know, we can make mistakes and people can change, and there has to be some type of a forgiveness in there. And a forgiveness for ourselves first. You know, yeah. I had to really address that portion of myself that realized that I was making mistakes and that I knew better, but I also was in a coping mechanism at the time, you know, and that's how I was trying to survive. But at the same time too, it wasn't jiving with the person that I was, you know, and it's hard because if you're open about everything except for just one thing, it's just so incongruent that it's like you're stuck in a wall in a corner. And I didn't want to feel that way anymore. And, you know, so even when I wrote this book, there were portions of it where I was just sobbing, you know, just writing these chapters, but it was just so helpful. And I encourage people out there to write, even if it's just for yourself, even if you write it and burn it. I mean, I think just getting those emotions out, even when people email me, just, you know, one email, all of a sudden I can just see them release just all this emotion. And that is just really important for people not to keep bottled up.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the mechanics a little bit for people mm-hmm. who kind of know what herpes is, but don't really know a lot of the specifics. So herpes is super common. I know that you've written that it's estimated that 80% of the U.S. population has either herpes simplex 1 or 2 and is mm-hmm. unaware. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the ways that you can transmit or acquire herpes. Just kind of start there.
Yeah. So the difficulty, I think, with estimating how many people have herpes is because it's not a reportable disease. It's different than HIV or syphilis or even gonorrhea and chlamydia. And so, you know, the CDC's current recommendation is not to be screening in a routine screening test. So when people come in and say, oh, hey, I'd like STD screening, they're not checking for herpes unless you specifically ask for it. And even then, when you specifically ask for it, some providers may not do it because the CDC recommendation is to just not. The thought process way back when was that herpes type 1 was the oral cold sores on the mouth. People usually get it, you know, when they're skiing out in the sun, you know, changes in diet, stress, things like that. And then herpes type 2 was considered genital. But now with the advent of oral sex and anal sex and, you know, different holes going everywhere, it's kind of gotten a little bit blurry about which goes where. And so certainly someone can test positive for herpes type 1 from oral sex on the genital area. And the difficulty too is that the transmission can be very difficult to detect because someone can transmit herpes to the genitalia even if they have a history of cold sores and don't have an outbreak. And that's actually the majority that I'm seeing currently of infections that are happening, you know, first time. Usually it's people who are exploring their sexuality. So it's around, you know, the early 20s, you know, late teens is when I'm seeing it. And, you know, the culture comes back positive for type one. And then they say, oh, I had oral sex at one point or another. And so it's getting very blurry. And so, you know, people out there say if you're sexually active, it's likely that you possibly have it and just don't know it. And so it's hard to shame people because you just don't know what their, you know, current status is.
Yeah. And it's transmitted via mucous membranes mm-hmm. and then like open sores, cuts, those kinds of things, right?
Right, exactly. So you think mucous membranes are essentially the kind of skin that's like in your mouth. So like your eyes, your mouth, your genitalia kind of has that like sensitive, you know, skin that can lubricate. Mm-hmm. That's the skin. And even if you are sexually active using condoms, it really doesn't end up protecting all the skin that's down there. So it's not uncommon for people to end up even with rectal outbreaks.
And also just quickly, so people are aware, we talked about this a little bit on the last one, but just to touch on it, that even if you don't have visible lesions, because of the shedding that can happen, you can transmit it even between outbreaks.
Correct. Yeah. So, first off, the transmission or the, from an unprotected intercourse is actually fairly low. So it's not 100%. If you're sexually active with someone who has herpes, you will absolutely 100% get it. So I think that that's an important thing to know. The most important things is to avoid sex when you have an active outbreak, using antiviral medications and then using condoms and having an open conversation about your sexual history is important too.
And fans of the show know that like one of my very favorite sex tools is gloves. Yeah. So let's also use gloves when we're having different various types of sex if we want to help protect ourselves. And especially if we have cuts in our hands or we've touched ourselves, those kind of things. Like there's lots of different ways to have super fun sex that don't have to involve genitals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think like one of the things that I just love too about your story is like, knowing the information isn't about scaring you out of having a wonderful, delicious sex life. It's about being informed so that everyone can choose for themselves what they want to engage in. And then you can have super hot sex from there.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think it actually increases intimacy because to show a vulnerable part of yourself to your partner and to have them respect that and reciprocate it, I think just elevates everything. And I actually found that my sex life improved by being honest. I mean, I will, you know, be very blatant. You know, I did not enjoy oral sex and I've kind of triggered it back and thought, well, maybe it was because I acquired this virus from oral sex. And until I actually disclosed it, good times. Good times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go. Mm-hmm. So if someone does get a positive diagnosis, mm-hmm. what do you think is one of the first things that they should do, especially if it wasn't with a doctor that was particularly prepared to kind of hold that emotional space and be there with you?
Yeah, and that's very, very common. First thing I always say with anything that you're just shocked and floored with is take a deep breath. I encourage people not to drive at that time. Don't go binge drinking. Don't go binge shopping. Just take a moment and kind of process what's going on. Because I do think that there's a grieving process that has to happen and an education process that has to happen. And so when patients, of course, we have the internet now, I'm always very cautious of the websites that people refer back to, just because there can be a lot of mom and pop websites out there with inaccurate or differing information. And so it's important to research that. And if they would like, they can always schedule another appointment to talk to their physician. I think that that is always an open door. And if they don't feel comfortable with that one, you know, perhaps they could seek out somebody else that they would feel comfortable. But I do find that when there is someone who has spent their whole life, you know, focused on medical training, and then the herpes positive person goes to them, there's just a little bit of reassurance that seems to be transmitted.
Yeah. And just a reminder too, that like, so much of why we have these big fear and anger feelings come up is because of the social stigma attached to it. It's kind of, we assume that it means we're going to be ostracized, never have sex again, nobody's going to want to touch us, we're going to be unlovable. And so, like, I think it's so important to let ourselves feel angry and sad, and then to also seek out folks who are doing really rad work in herpes, like yourself or Ella Dawson and her amazing TED Talk, or you mentioned an organization called Herpes Opportunity.
Yeah, there's actually quite several places, and there's even a few kind of underground Facebook groups that do exist. And there's some people, when they get to that point of dating, you know, there's a lot of dating websites that are out there for patients who are STD positive, sex positive places. So I think that there's a lot of options than we probably had 20, 30 years ago. And so it's just seeking them out. And even just confiding in one other person, I think is so huge, whether it's a therapist, a best friend, a partner, a mom. It's not uncommon for people to contact me, or even the moms to contact me, just asking for how to support someone. Just by unleashing, you know, the top of the kettle, just all that hot air just kind of goes out. And I think that there is some reassurance in there. But I will say, you know, there are some people out there, granted it took me 10, 15 years to get where I am. And so I still had to go through that grieving process, you know, 13 years later. So that process has to happen. And I would just love for people to respect that natural thing, because eventually it just ends up being time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So something else that was interesting that I actually didn't know, as I was reading your book, and so I love learning all the things, and reading all the facts to my husband, listen to this, was you were talking about how over the course of time, outbreaks tend to decrease over the years and decades. And I think also that finding the support has been such an important part of how a lot of the people you've worked with have gotten through this. And so I'd love it if you could just talk a little bit about kind of over the course of time, like, I think a lot of people are just scared of the knowledge in those conversations, but like, what does it look like 10, 15, 20 years after you've gotten a diagnosis?
Yeah. So I will say that the diagnosis and the outbreaks do not look like the internet pictures. Those are sensationalized, dramatic, rare occurrences. Most of the times when patients come in, it's maybe one or two little spots. Sometimes I see a little bit more after that, and that's perhaps someone who thought that they had a urinary tract infection or a yeast infection that wouldn't go away or something like that. So, you know, if you catch it early enough, it actually doesn't do this big explosion that's on the internet. I mean, those are just dramatic, and I wish we could anatomically kind of put pictures that are more appropriate. But usually the first year of an outbreak is the worst, because the body is trying to figure out and build its immune system to the virus. And so it's not uncommon for people to have 6, 8, 10 outbreaks the first year. Generally after that, I have found that it decreases for people as life goes on. I will say I very rarely at this point ever get an outbreak. Whether it's, you know, I've taken better care of myself, which I always think is very important just for mind, body, spirit. So it could be that, you know, in which case too, I'm managing my stress level, which can be a trigger. And sometimes people can figure out what their triggers are. Some people find that it's with waxing. Some people find it's with a new sexual partner. And so figuring it out and perhaps avoiding it can be helpful. And some people that I've spoken with, if they feel like they're starting to get an outbreak, and whether for them that means an itching or a tingling or even a cut, or some people even, you know, were first diagnosed with genital outbreaks but now have more rectal outbreaks, you know, they'll just take the antiviral medication and it decreases the length of time, the pain, the outbreak in general. So it's a wonderful medication. People have not become resilient to it, like things like penicillin or other antibiotics out there. So it's benign, I think it's helpful. And in the end, it's just learning how to understand the triggers of your body and try to avoid them and maximize your health the best that you can.
So the one thing I want to say to everybody listening who either has herpes or has genital warts or has HIV, or for many of us, we'll have at some point in our lives, that you are beautiful and lovable and there is nothing wrong with you, whether you have a virus or not. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know for you, like, what's the one thing that you so want people to just understand about living with some type of STI?
I think in the end, we all have things in our lives that we have to overcome. The mind is by far the most powerful organ in our whole body. And with all those little synapses and neurotransmitters that transfer back and forth, I really think that there's an emotional investment that we should have to move forward from anything. My story and my platform started with herpes, but I think that it transfers into, you know, issues of childhood abuse, trauma, infertility, pelvic pain. It's such a wide variety, and we all, even from the outside, the most perfect person you could ever think of is battling something on the inside, because, you know, we have layers of pressures and stories layered upon us. And I'm just really just trying to get down to my naked self and really just kind of just be exactly who I am. And I think we can all get there if we put in the work and develop the self-love that we all deserve.
So I'd love to shift gears a little bit. Mm-hmm. I get emails somewhat periodically from folks who are experiencing a great deal of shame over how their vulva looks. Mm-hmm. Usually because their vulva doesn't look like the vulvas that they're seeing in porn, which is pretty much the only place that we ever see vulvas in this world.
Yes.
And I know you, because of what you do, have seen thousands and thousands and thousands of vulvas in all states and all ages.
Yes.
And I would love it if you could just talk a little bit about the variety of vulvas out there and kind of what you've experienced and what you would like to say to someone who feels like maybe they're different.
For the same reason that we all have different hair types, hair oiliness, you know, noses and everything, the vulva is exactly the same. And I think it's actually very unique and beautiful that we're all different. I mean, if we all look the same, how boring would that be? You know, there's a wonderful book that one of my colleagues has that actually, I think, has like 200 vulvas in there, because a lot of times patients will come and say, I want to look like this. You need to trim this, trim that, make it go together, forget the 5 babies I just had, and make it look like I was when I was 16 years old. The reality of it is that you had 5 children, beautiful children that you delivered vaginally, and that is absolutely something to be proud of. And our anatomy is created for a reason. And it really protects the sensitive skin on the inside. And, you know, a lot of patients come to me and say, you know, I'd like surgery, but at the same time too, that is generally at the expense of changing, you know, into symmetry, into pelvic pain, into vaginal strictures. And, you know, it's just not always worth it. You know, it always comes back down to that self-love, self-confidence thing. But I will say that everybody is different. Everybody is unique. And some patients like to say, oh my goodness, I'm so embarrassed. The last time you saw me, this, that, and the other. And I was like, I barely remember the vulva I just checked, you know, right before you. So nobody remembers. Nobody remembers. And if it's something that's coming from a partner, I think it's important to say that, number one, are they the judge?
Right. <You know>?
Are they the expert? Number two, does it function for you? If it's functioning, fantastic. And number three, if they're looking at it, hopefully that means that you're getting sex, in which case, great job. Keep going. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the question. Like, should they be the judge? Because I think you're so right. Like, if you're not experiencing pain or some type of medical issue, mm-hmm. and if you can experience pleasure with the mm-hmm. genitals that you have, mm-hmm. unless you want to change your genitals because of a gender identity type of thing,
sure. mm-hmm.
You know, I think, like, just I used to have a co-host, and she always talked about how her wife at the time had like great big meat curtain labia. And she loved that because she had so much more to put in her mouth.
Yeah.
And so like, I think it just comes with that. If someone's commenting on your genitals, no matter what genitals you have, I think the response needs to be like, they give me pleasure and this is mine and you don't get to comment on them.
Right. Or if you have an issue with it, go ahead and move along, because in the end you want someone who accepts you for everything that you, you are, everything that you are. And it's for the same reason that a lot of patients come to me wanting to be evaluated for vaginal discharge because their partner says that they have an odor. I will tell you that area has a scent in general, and that is sexy. You know, that is something that to be applauded for and not be evaluated.
Yeah, that's something else that I personally find a little bit bothersome is this trend that I've seen off and on over the years of wanting to make your vulva smell like lavender or like roses, because the unspoken rule is that like pussies smell bad. And so we don't want that smell. We want to introduce a different smell. And I think that really just comes down to like fear of women's pleasure and fear of the unknown. And so I love that you brought that up, because like, they should smell like vulva. I mean, it's a vulva, so it should smell like a vulva.
Exactly. And, you know, I have patients who apologize. Oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't shower before I came in. Or, oh, my goodness, I didn't wax or shave. And I'm just like, you are in your natural state. That is fine. You know, if there's something wrong, if there is an infection, it will come through regardless of if it is primed and proper and, you know, ready for presentation.
Rolling out the red carpet. Yes.
We don't even notice. As an OBGYN, we don't even breathe through our noses anymore. You know, it's fine.
Trick of the trade.
Yeah.
So one of the things that delighted me when I was researching you was you were very proudly sharing that recently you've had so many people tell you that they rave about your pap smears. And one, I think that's fantastic, because that's usually a great point of concern for folks who have a vulva.
Yes.
So one, I would love it if you could just talk through a little bit like why you think you're so great at them.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons why I went into OBGYN in the first place is, and I think most OBGYNs, is because you have to make people feel comfortable right from the get-go. You know, you maybe only have 5-10 minutes to talk to someone before you're like, all right, let's go, let's do this. Most people need 4 dates and like, you know, a lot of talking. And so I only have 15 minutes. So I think building that comfort level is really important. I've discovered that when I also take the tone of the patient and, you know, talk a little bit slower and a little bit calmer, all of the anxiety that I see in them just kind of relaxes a little bit. And a lot of it is just really getting to know, well, tell me about your family history, or, you know, tell me about your social history. And then it just kind of just mellows down a little bit. One of the important things I think too, when doing an exam, is I know people think it's very funny when OBGYNs are like, okay, keep scooting down, like I promise you, you don't fall off the bed. It just doesn't happen. People don't like fall off the other end. So I find that when you can literally bring your butt cheeks probably about halfway down until they're falling off, it actually tilts the cervix. It makes it a little bit more comfortable for me to see it. And then one of the other things that I do too is that I just tell the patients where I am. So they usually actually send people to me who have either never been sexually active or have been abused in the past. Whether it's my technique, whether it's my demeanor, I'm not sure. But just letting them know, okay, I'm here by your knee. And then I'm like tracking all the way down. Okay, I'm right here. I'm right here. I'm right here. I generally use the smallest speculum that I have, but I find my trick is yoga breathing. And that's actually something that I try to impart on on my medical students, because, you know, nobody wants just something jammed in without knowing.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's important just to kind of, especially in a clinical situation that's medical, and intimate. And so really just, I usually do it in a few breaths. And if I can feel the patient tensing up, I just kind of wait. And in their own space, they end up relaxing. Because with yoga breathing, breathing in and then breathing out, the pelvic floor actually relaxes and allows that speculum to go in. And I'm just following the patient's lead. And I find that when I end up doing that and then I just poop, poop, pap, poop, poop, HPV, it's done. It's done. I mean, everybody survives a pap smear. Everybody survives a pap smear. Everybody, you know, leaves smiling. So knowing that you have that end point, you can get there.
Yeah. I have a lot of listeners, myself included, who are rape and assault survivors, people who have PTSD and trauma. I also have a lot of listeners who are trans and non-binary, and so they have very different feelings and expectations and needs. And so I'm wondering if you can give some advice to folks who either have trauma or who are in some type of marginalized body for finding doctors who could be a good fit for them, and also ways they can advocate for themselves to ensure they have the least traumatic and stressful experience possible.
Absolutely. And, you know, I will say that every physician is different. Some of us have great days. Some of us have really bad days, you know. And so, you know, even someone who is very open and communicative on some day may not. And it's unfortunate because I know this is a very delicate meeting for this patient. And so what I actually encourage is you can either do the research ahead of time, you know, find out who's in your network, who carries your insurance or whatever, and you can try Yelping, you can talk to other people, and essentially you're looking for someone that's open, honest, educated. You know, if you end up finding those characteristics, you can always go and interview them. You know, there's no harm in just going and talking to someone and just, you know, you can feel their demeanor when they walk into a room or when they sit and talk to you. And there's a lot of different providers. It can be a nurse practitioner. It could be a physician, whether it's an MD or a DO, like my degree. And so, you know, there are going to be people who are a wide variety. Essentially you're just looking for someone who's open and willing to listen. And then you can just kind of see where you go. I really do believe in following the gut instinct. If you feel like you, and if this physician enters into a room and you feel already guarded, just past just normal guarded of a new person, but are feeling some type of tension or emotional reaction, may not be the best because you're looking for an environment that's warm so that you can confide, because in the end, your physician has the knowledge that can hopefully help you with whatever's happening medically. And so it might take a little bit of searching, and that's okay. But hopefully when you find that right person in that home, then things will just fall into place moving forward. I will say that they're, you know, my company specifically, which I'm very proud to work for, has really stepped forward in terms of working on transgender, non-binary, the community. And we've integrated that health into, or that community into our healthcare, you know, with specific support systems and education for the physicians. I actually just finished diversity training for the physicians and the staff. Because this is a huge new community that's coming up, and I think support is of the utmost importance. And we've really put a stress on the providers to build that knowledge because we know that it's coming.
First of all, thank you for all of that. That's so helpful, and I think it's something that doesn't get talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And I also just like want to reiterate what you said about trusting your gut of – you don't have to follow through on anything unless you're in an emergency situation and you have to get the care for some type of really, really urgent reason. Your choices may be more limited, but for routine care and for small things, like, I think it's so important to remember that if you get a feeling of just like, I'm feeling really uncomfortable or something about this isn't working, like, you're allowed to put a stop to what's happening, to say, okay, I don't want to do this. I'm going to find somebody else. Like, it might be an uncomfortable conversation to have, but you're allowed to choose yourself ahead of their feelings.
You can be a power to your medical care. You do not have to do anything that you don't want to do. I mean, I'm assuming that most of the listeners are adults. If you are an adult, you can make an informed decision. And at any point, if you feel uncomfortable, you can just stop. I mean, even with everything that I've done, I've had patients come in who were survivors who had the best intent of doing a pap smear, but just could not. Just the thought of putting the legs into the stirrups was terrifying. I could see it. Her sister could see it. And there's no reason to force anything. In the end, if something's going to be happening and something goes wrong, you can evaluate it at that time. I do think that preventative health is extremely important, but not at the expense of crippling you for the next month because it was just so traumatizing. There's no need for that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that permission slip, because I think so many of us need to be reminded that we do have power in these situations, even if they feel very exposed and powerless.
Yeah. I think a physician will let you know if it's not right. You know, I think that there's a huge patient autonomy that can happen. But if at any point, like for instance, when I'm on labor and delivery, you know, patients can go through things to a certain extent. I want them to have their experience. But if at any point that there's jeopardy of life, I will directly say, listen, not okay. This is the situation. We have to be, you know, make something more definitive. But if it's a situation of that someone is struggling with and it's, you know, a pap smear, or just a breast exam or something like that, not necessary. I think that there can be other ways to evaluate and that would be okay.
Yeah. So I'd love to end with one last thing. We were talking ahead of time and I was just kind of curious about your experience with like kink and pregnancy. And you mentioned that at one point, a couple of years ago, you did have someone ask you if they could engage in fisting while pregnant. And I know lots of listeners are very into fisting. And so I would love if you could just let us know, like, what was the final verdict on that?
Yeah. So, she was actually, it was when I was in residency and I think she was maybe even 16 or 17 years old. And so I was still in residency. So I had my attending there and we both kind of went, huh, that's a question we don't get asked often. And I guess we both kind of looked at each other and we thought, well, if you're okay with it, I think we're okay with it too. Because I mean, as long as bar that there isn't any medical problems, you know, there are people who prefer to have anal sex in pregnancy. There are some people who prefer to do fisting or anything like that. And I think it's fine as long as there isn't any risk of preterm labor. There isn't really any risk, I think, to the baby. However, it can cause vaginal soreness, which can be confused as labor. So, you know, it'd have to be in the right situation. And of course, you know, make sure that you're well lubricated. The difficulty is, you know, that baby is right there. That cervix is right there. And you really don't want to introduce preterm labor, you know, and to explain it, oh, because we were fisting. You kind of want to make sure you're doing it in the right situation, you know?
Yeah.
And for the same reason that I had someone say, you know, she kept coming in with recurrent bacterial infections. And I kept thinking, what is going on? What are you doing? And so eventually she said something, you know, if I have anal sex, can I go back to oral or vaginal? And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Anal sex is the final stop. You don't go anywhere else because that is just going to introduce bacteria that you just don't want. So, you know, you have to be very logical about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just use a little bit of information gathering and proceed with caution sounds to be the wisdom of the day.
Yes. And always check with your provider because every, you know, pregnancy can develop a little bit differently and some things that may be appropriate at some times may not be in other times. And so it's important for us to know kind of where you're at.
Thank you for all of that information. That was amazing.
That was very fun.
Yeah. So I would love it if you could share with listeners how they can get your book and stay in touch with you and find you online.
Absolutely. So I have a few venues to be reached. The place that I usually am working off of is actually off of Facebook. So if you go to facebook.com/Dr. Sheila, SHEILAGYN. I generally try to post about once a week about something, whether it's something that moved me, whether it's something I was doing for myself, whether it's some type of interview that I did. I'll refer to other herpes advocates that are out there. So that's a really great way to reach me. And you can send messages there if you're looking for more support. My book is on Amazon and you can search my name, Sheila. My last name is Lawanzon, LOANZ as in zebra, ON. And you can purchase that and you can see my journey and all the fun stories that we talked about here. And then lastly, I do have my website and that's at www.drsheilalawanzon.com.
awesome. I will have all of those links on Sex Gets Real for this episode and in the show notes, so you can just click through really easily. I also want to remind you, ask your libraries to carry this book. If you've got people in your life who need to learn about herpes, or even if you want your kids to just learn more because mm-hmm. they're teenagers and they're becoming sexually active, like, let's get ahead of the stigma mm-hmm. and the bad information and get that book for them. I want to thank you so much for being on the show and just being so lovely and warm and open with us. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Dawn. It was super fun. I love this kind of stuff.
Me too. And to everybody who listened, thank you so much for tuning in. If you have questions or thoughts about this episode, you can use the contact form at Sex Gets Real. Of course, there's an anonymous option. And if you have any questions or comments you want to share with me for a future episode, you can go there as well. Until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah. Bye.